It is important that this point is made and that people realize how bad the European Union, the European mission is for Europe.
De-dollarization is being done. We'll find out in South Africa when the BRICS meet, but I'm sure a lot is going to come out of that. Thank you, Peter Koenig, former World Bank economist. Shabir Rizvi, economic analyst from London. Thank you. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Ikova Tafwe and the team. It's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحيي يا ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيه
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things. And no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed, and He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Sudan's RSF paramilitary group announces a 72-hour ceasefire after 6 days of clashes with the army. North Korea says its status as a nuclear power is irreversible, vowing strong action in response to any U.S. violation of its sovereignty. Also ahead, rail workers go on strike across Germany, calling for better pay as the cost of living crisis bites. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour: clashes between Sudan's army and a paramilitary group grind on as residents in the capital and its sister city, Bahri, reports gunfire. That comes as the Rapid Support Force group declares a 3-day truce with the army. The RSF says the humanitarian truce aims to evacuate citizens during the Muslim holiday of Eid al-Fitr. The army is yet to respond to the ceasefire, but its chief had earlier said he would support an armistice if it allowed citizens to move freely. Thousands of Sudanese streamed out of Khartoum as explosions rang out on Thursday. The United Nations has voiced concern over the safety of citizens, calling for a ceasefire. At least 350 people have been killed since clashes broke out between the army and the RSF on Saturday. The violence follows weeks of tensions over the planned integration of the group into the army. North Korea says its status as a nuclear power is irreversible and will remain an undeniable reality even if the US and its allies deny it. North Korean Foreign Minister Cho Son-hwa made the remarks in reaction to a recent statement by the group of seven countries. She accused the G7 of interfering in her country's internal affairs. Chow said Pyongyang will continue legitimate action to eliminate military threats from the U.S. and its allies. She said North Korea's development of nuclear weapons is only intended to guard its against U.S. threats. Chow warned that North Korea will take strong action if the U.S. and its allies attempt to violate its sovereignty and interests. Her remarks came amid simmering tension on the Korean Peninsula over the joint military drills by the U.S. and its allies. Pyongyang has slammed those drills as a rehearsal for, quote, an all-out nuclear war. In recent years, Iran has made great headways in manufacturing a broad range of indigenous military equipment, particularly drones. Now, the Iranian Defense Ministry has delivered 200 drones to the different divisions of the army. Our correspondent Mehdi Abbasian reports.
Iran's defense ministry has made mass delivery of new combat and reconnaissance drones to Iran's army in a ceremony attended by Defense Minister Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Gharayi Ashtiani, as well as the commanders of different divisions of the Iranian army. With the goal of increasing the power of the drone fleet of the Islamic Republic of Iran's army, 200 new indigenously built drones were delivered to the ground force, the navy, the air force, and the air defense force. Minister of Defense and Armed Forces Logistics of Iran hailed the country's advances in drone production, saying that the Islamic Republic's defense doctrine is entirely based on deterrence.
The more powerful the Islamic Republic's deterrent power, the better it can help countries that seek security and stability in the region. Certainly, Iran can help them because its military prowess has contributed to providing peace and stability in the region, and the drones that were delivered to the armed forces today are part of the country's defensive power. This trend will continue.
Iranian experts have made giant strides in boosting defense power by producing various equipment, including different types of drones. Iran's drone program has become a significant deterrent in the region due to the country's ability to conduct combat and reconnaissance missions using these UAVs. Also, Iran's army commander, Major General Abdulrahim Mousavi, highlighted the growing power of the drones used by army units.
With different ranges, sizes, and weights, these drones can perform all kinds of missions for the Islamic Republic of Iran's army. The experience of using drones in new battlefields has shown that they have a significant and decisive effect. This enables the Iranian army to have the upper hand in the battlefield.
The Navy will have a drone range of 2,000 kilometers with the addition of these drones to its fleet. This means that our operational radius will increase significantly. And in addition, due to capabilities of the drones, we can stalk and hunt subsurface targets such as submarines.
The ground forces of the Islamic Republic of Iran's army itself is a manufacturer of UAVs. We built drones in different scales, from large to small, that can have strategic effects on the battlefield. In general, drones are a unique and effective weapon and can improve our country's combat power.
There has been very good cooperation with the Defense Ministry. We do appreciate all their efforts. These are operational drones that will definitely be effective in improving the operational power of the Air Force. We plan to use UAVs and planes with a single central command to engage targets.
The delivery of 200 new drones to the Army is part of an agreement with the Defense Ministry on the promotion of drone power and the equipment carried by the unmanned military aircraft. Last year, the Iranian Defense Ministry and the Army signed a strategic agreement. Under Phase 1 of the agreement, the Defense Ministry has undertaken to equip the Army with 1,000 drones.
Elsewhere, commuters are left stranded in Germany as rail workers are on strike across the country to demand higher wages. The commuters face disruptions as services by at least 50 companies, including the National Railway Operator, are halted. Germany's Rail Workers Union is demanding a 12% wage increase. The National Operator backs a 5% rise. Meantime, workers at four major airports are also on strike for the second day on Friday. The industrial action forced the cancellation of around 700 flights a day earlier. Countries across Europe have been facing strikes by public and private workers since last year. That's because the workers want higher pay as food and energy prices have sharply increased, partly due to the war in Ukraine. High inflation and rising interest rates lead to a spike in business closures across the 27-nation European Union. Critics blame sanctions against Russia, which have resulted in unbearably high energy, production, transportation, and rental costs. Jerome Hughes is in Brussels.
It seems everywhere you look in Brussels, the EU's de facto capital, shops have closed down. The European Trade Union Confederation, ETUC, says business bankruptcies in the EU are at their highest since 2015. Sanctions against Russia over the war in Ukraine are ensuring inflation remains painfully high. Citizens say prices continue to rise.
Everything, food at the supermarket, clothes, traveling, airplane tickets.
If the war ends tomorrow, we will have like some years to adapt and to go back to the prices of before war.
It's very hard for young people to even stay in the EU anymore. It's a lot more enticing to, you know, move to Australia or, you know, Canada or somewhere else.
The ETUC warns the European Central Bank risks throwing the Eurozone into a deep recession through its policy of continuing to increase interest rates in an effort to control inflation. Trade unions say wages and working conditions in the EU are deteriorating at a time when the cost of living remains extremely high. They say millions are struggling to put food on the table, while food and energy companies make record profits as a result of price speculation. Another threat to the EU's economy relates to skills shortages. The European Commission has just launched yet another plan designed to overhaul the 27-nation bloc's education and training systems to meet the needs of this digital age.
Almost 3 in 4 businesses say that they do not find employees with enough digital skills. And that, of course, means that these businesses cannot invest, cannot grow.
But experts say high borrowing costs due to rising interest rates are the main factor stifling business growth right now. It's suggested failed Western efforts to try and punish Russia have backfired. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Russia's foreign minister is on a four-nation tour in Latin America as part of Moscow's efforts to boost the trade and investment ties. In Brazil, Sergei Lavrov called for the expansion of business relations and thanked President Lula da Silva for his efforts to resolve the Ukraine conflict. Lula drew criticism from Washington for his remarks that the West had been encouraging war by arming Ukraine. And in Venezuela, Lavrov emphasized the importance of joining forces against, quote, Western sanctions blackmail.
Russia's foreign minister Sergei Lavrov visited Brazil, the first stop on his tour of Latin America that is taking place on April 17th to 21st. Lavrov met with Brazil's top leadership and his counterpart Mauro Vieira. The top two diplomats last met on the sidelines of a G20 foreign ministers meeting in New Delhi in March. During his visit, Lavrov said the West is trying to dominate the international arena. His Brazilian counterpart, for his part, rejected US claims that Brazil is parroting Russian and Chinese propaganda. Washington's criticism came after Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva said the West is encouraging the Ukraine war and that the US and Europe need to start talking about peace.
We, as I have already said, reaffirmed our focus on developing our strategic partnership in all areas. We paid special attention to trade and economic cooperation, investment cooperation, where a record level was reached last year, exceeding $8 billion, and this is far from the limit. And today we talked about the areas that needed to be developed in the interests of our countries and our citizens. That is, of course, energy, and of course, such a sector of energy as the peaceful use of atomic energy. There are very good interactions and good prospects.
Lavrov's trip to Brazil comes after Lula's top foreign policy advisor met with Russian President Vladimir Putin at the Kremlin in March. Lavrov's next stop was Venezuela's capital, Caracas, where he met with a Venezuelan president. Nicolas Maduro received Sergei Lavrov in the presidential palace in Caracas. The two sides discussed to expand bilateral cooperation in different fields, including energy, investment, trade and finance. The top Russian diplomat also held talks with his Venezuelan counterpart, Ivan Gil. In a joint press conference, Lavrov emphasized the importance of joining forces against what he called Western sanctions blackmail.
We agreed on practical measures to expand trade and investment cooperation and contacts between business circles, of course, taking into account current realities. We have numerous projects in the field of oil production, development of gas fields, agriculture, medicine and pharmaceuticals, communications, space and new technologies. We will increase the volume and pace of interaction in all these areas and will continue to energetically use existing mechanisms for this purpose, including the high-level intergovernmental commission that I have already mentioned.
Since the beginning of the Ukraine war, new alliances have been forged in the global arena. Latin America has also gained a significant position in Russia's foreign policy agenda. It is now believed that the region is one of the centers of the formation of a multipolar world order. Russia is now seeking to maintain dialogue and develop constructive cooperation there.
The war in Ukraine has produced significant geostrategic changes worldwide. One of these changes has been the alliances of some countries with Russia, although Latin America is a region made up of countries with varied historical, political, economic and social trajectories, it has gained geostrategic relevance in the objectives pursued by Russian foreign policy. In general terms, the leading Latin American sectors that attract Russian investment are the use of natural resources, information technology, and the automotive, nuclear, and aerospace industries. Russian companies' principal assets in using natural resources go to the bauxite mines in Jamaica, Guyana, and Peru, as well as the projects of Gazprom, Lukoil, and Rosneft in Argentina, Bolivia, Brazil, Cuba, and Venezuela. Russia has also secured the provision of fertilizers to Brazil, which imports large quantities of them from the country. Brazil will increase its exports of meat to the Russian Federation, helping the country in its efforts to replace products affected by sanctions. Today, Argentina, Brazil, and Mexico are the most important markets for Russia. These three countries are members of the G20 as well as Russia. Bilateral trade has increased significantly since the beginning of the 21st century, especially with Brazil during the presidency of Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva and in the early years of Dilma Rousseff. Furthermore, Lavrov's visit to the region is also seen as Moscow's growing presence in Latin America and an affront against the United States.
That brings an end to world news for this hour.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Iran Sat or Bat 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness. And I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets and thy messengers whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive. And make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans. And muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only Thou, art the mighty ones.
God's Month. In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, Salam and welcome to another episode of this series. We start the last episode of this series with a supplication from the Prophet's 16th fallible successor, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace upon him. My Lord, you have said in your holy book, the Noble Quran, that the month of Ramadan is the month in which the Quran has been revealed as the source of guidance and salvation of people and the means of distinguishing truth from falsehood. Now, the month of Ramadan is ending, so I ask you to forgive any sin which has remained with me and you have not forgiven it or want to punish me for it before the last dawn of this blessed month, and overlook my shortcoming, O most merciful of the merciful. Ramadan is ending with all beauties and blessings. The faithful are happy and sad. They are happy as they have succeeded to worship God as much as they could. They are sad because they are losing the unique hours and moments of this month. Thus, they pray to God to keep the spirituality of this blessed month for them. Now that Ramadan is leaving us, we had better think of our achievements in this blessed month. Some people tried in this month to refrain not only from eating and drinking, but also from evil thoughts and spites. They tried to help the poor and strengthen their bond with the kin and kith. They practiced how to love others and help the weak and the needy. Ramadan was the month of practicing patience and asking God to forgive our sins. This has been mentioned in Abu Hamza's supplication, where we ask God, and gather us with Prophet Muhammad Mustafa and transfer us to the degree of repenting towards you. The Prophet's fourth infallible successor, Imam Sajjad, peace upon him, also tells God in the special supplication for bidding farewell to Ramadan, "You are the one who have opened the door to your forgiveness called At-Tawbah." By the way, how could we get rid of compunction if there was no way to repent? Apology and accepting it by merciful God grants us hope to take refuge with him and make the heavy load of sins a little light. That's why penitence has been emphasized so much. Consider a young boy who has left his parents for any reason. After a while, he returns to them and faces their love and affection. This is penitence. In this modern world that human beings are plunged in monotonous routine habits, there are fewer signs of spiritual bonds. Therefore, the blessed month of Ramadan is a very good period to reinforce such bonds with fellow humans and brothers in faith. In this month, we may have achieved some virtues and kept aloof from some vices. Now, we should try to continue the same route. The blessed month of Ramadan is treasure trove of virtues, which can be looted by Satan through negligence. Imam Sajjad, peace upon him, says in his supplication while parting with the blessed month of Ramadan, O Allah, the month of Ramadan was praised among us and was a good helper for us and bestowed us the most precious benefits of the world people. But in the due time, as its days ended, it bade farewell. O Allah, now we are bidding it farewell like the farewell with a dear one whose parting is hard for us and whose leaving saddens us. Farewell to you, the month which came with plenty blessings and washed us from the pollutions of sin. What evils that left us with your coming and what good things that we were granted to us. O Allah, bless Muhammad and his progeny. We are sad with the passing of this month. Grant us good reward on the sorrow of this parting. Imam Sajjad, peace upon him, continues, O Allah, take us out from our sins with the going of this month and relieve us from our evils with its exit and place us among the happiest in this month and those who have gained the most in this month and those who have enjoyed the most in this month. O Allah, bless Muhammad and his progeny and record for us like the reward of those who have fasted this month till the day of resurrection or have worshipped you in it.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Midstream.
When the confrontation starts and when it ends. What is important, however, is that the outcome has been decided in advance. The resistance is heading towards establishing a new equation linking Al-Quds with the West Bank. This means that any attack on the first will be repelled from the second. This is indicated by a senior source in the resistance stressing that things are excellent and the battle is being managed wisely. Undoubtedly, the enemy will try to make the Palestinians pay a heavy price for their aspiration to perpetuate that equation, hoping to mitigate its losses in the long term at a minimum. By announcing the West Bank as the shield of Al-Quds, the resistance axis showed that it is ready for an open battle that may intensify, may be prolonged. The memory of International Al-Quds Day this year comes with a special charm after the failure of all internal and external conspiracies to harm the Axis of Resistance, which recorded on this day authentic and courageous stances that made Palestine the issue of a nation in the heart, spirit, and conscience of the entire Muslim Ummah and in the hearts of all the free people of the world. The revival of Quds Day this year had its own dimensions, which are embodied in a clear image like the sun in broad daylight, whose title is that we are closer to Al-Quds, as this year comes in light of the victories recorded by the resistance on all fronts, starting with Tehran, passing through Yemen, Iraq, Lebanon, and Syria, and inside Al-Quds itself. As for the resistance missiles launched from multiple fronts on the occupied lands, they drew a roadmap for the liberation of Palestine amid a state of rallying Palestinians, Arabs, Muslims, and pro-Palestine free people of the world around the resistance and its options aimed at stifling the Zionist project on the land of Palestine, this time from the West Bank. One of the most prominent manifestations of the scene today is the success of the Axis of Resistance in forming a broad and cohesive front. This was done by consolidating the concept of the unity of the comprehensive arenas of the Axis of Resistance, which was practically embodied by defending Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque from three fronts simultaneously. This translates the concept of the unity of the squares into a practical reality that deters the arrogance of Israel and its encroachment on the Islamic sanctities in Al-Quds. Announcing the West Bank as the shield of Al-Quds during the anniversary of International Al-Quds Day comes this year as Israel suffers from two crises. One escalating crisis that led to a state of increasing internal erosion, and another crisis of confronting the escalation of resistance on various fronts in general and on the Palestinian fronts combined in particular, which all have become sources of unprecedented threat and concern for the Israeli occupation entity. Welcome to the Middle East Stream, Amar Osman. Under the slogan, "The West Bank is the shield of Al-Quds," and with the huge demonstrations, Muslims in a number of countries of the world celebrated the International Al-Quds Day in response to the call of Imam Khomeini to affirm the eligibility of the Palestinian cause. Now, the West Bank has deserved its shield crowned with more than 98 martyrs, or even 100, some say, since the beginning of this very exceptional year, as an entitlement to the duty to stand up to the genocidal Zionist occupation. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Omar Nashabi, political commentator and lawyer expert in human rights. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Nashabi. Now, the advanced West Bank front in the fields of the Axis of Resistance, extending through the unity of the arenas and the unity of the fronts of the Axis of Resistance, was crowned this year on while we were commemorating the International Al-Quds Day as the shield of Al-Quds. They chose the West Bank, the resistance chose it to be a spearhead in the throes of major transformations towards Al-Quds. Now, but what does this crowning really mean for the Quds and for the Axis of Resistance in general?
Yes, thank you for having me on the show. It is now clear that the liberation of Palestine and being able to liberate Al-Quds can only be done through unity. And Al-Quds, the speech of Imam Khomeini and the call for the last Friday of the month of this holy month of Ramadan as Al-Quds Day is a call for unity for all Muslims all around the world in this holy month. And, you know, the Israelis have been, disrupting all kinds, even simple religious practices that are really, you know, something that is that goes without saying. It's a basic right internationally. And violently, the Israeli army has been obstructing, beating Muslims inside the mosque, inside the holy places. And, you know, this year it coincides, Al-Quds Day coincides with Easter for the Christians. And the Israelis did the same practices same practices of, humiliation, degradation, beating up people when they are going to pray. These images all around the world also contributed to the main core idea of Al-Quds Day for unity of all people around the world, Christians and Muslims, to face the Israeli aggression and the Israeli occupation that is ongoing for such a long time.
Well, Dr. Nashabi, Al-Quds is regaining its role, as we have seen, especially this year, with the audacity of its youth to avenge the massacres that the occupiers have committed, whether in Jenin, in Nablus, all over the West Bank, or in the old city of Al-Quds itself, the likes of martyrs Uday Tamimi, Khairi Alqam, Hussein Qaraqi, and many, many more distinguished martyrs who embraced the sacrifices of the West Bank and basically just lit the oil of revenge in Al-Quds lanterns. And with it was a wondrous Palestinian cohesion that we saw, unprecedented cohesion. Can we say that Al-Quds has returned to its lawful place in the heart of the Ummah, or maybe there's more to be done before we see that?
Well, it has always been in the heart of the Ummah. It never lost its place to regain it. However, we feel today that Al-Quds is again at the center stage. Why do we feel this? We feel this because, we are closer to victory. Every year, every day, since Imam Khomeini announced the Al-Quds Day, we are closer to the liberation of Al-Quds and the liberation of Palestine, and to be victorious over this kind of entity that is violating the basic rights of millions of people in this part of the world and all over the world.
But it seems that this year it has gained more momentum, given that in previous years maybe the Arab world was divided over issues in Yemen and Syria and Iraq and Lebanon sometimes. But this year you see everyone standing together for Al-Quds. What's the reason behind that?
Well, and it comes at a time when there is a rapprochement between the various Muslims from and various governments in the whole region, and that is also very significant. And it also is related to what I said at the beginning, that this is, the unity. When people, Muslims, Arabs, people in the region come together, all those who believe in basic rights, more unity, we get closer to victory. That is very clear, and that's why the Israeli has been working on creating divisions in the Arab and Islamic world on a constant path to actually create these divisions, and they have failed. Today we have people coming together to call for justice, and that is essential, and I think that is what we are feeling today, and we are getting closer and closer to victory.
I'm very interested in discussing with you why the West Bank was distinguished, basically, in its red valleys from the rest of the steel rings of the axis of resistance and its squares that united the defense, the oppressed worshippers. I mean, we saw rockets coming from the holy Jabal Amal mountain, which rained down through the mountains of occupied mountains of Matulla and Naharia in occupied Palestine. And then we saw rockets coming from Gaza towards occupied Palestine. And to complete the ring of fire, there was also rockets from the occupied Syrian Golan. And now, I mean, we see legendary steadfastness from the West Bank, also with operations that are individual but not lone wolf. They yes. are planned, but they are individual operations.
Yes.
What are the options left here for Israel after such a fierce confrontation, and what is really the role of the West Bank in all of this?
Yes. Well, I don't think the Israelis have a lot of options left, but the role of the various fronts is to complement each other and create like a united front. However, the West Bank has a particularly important position because the West Bank, you cannot have access to Jerusalem. The closest access to Jerusalem, to Al-Quds, is from the West Bank. Hence, the West Bank will have a special role in the coming weeks and days. And, the Palestinians themselves in the West Bank, are in contact with the Palestinians all over occupied Palestine, and they know the terrain, they know, and they have gained a lot of experience through many years of confronting the Israelis. They know how to hit and where to hit, and I think that they will actually increase their resistance operation against the Israelis, and it is their basic right according to international law, and I think they will step it up, especially as Eid al-Fitr is coming at the end of this week.
Well, I do hope to see someday Palestine. Maybe we can take that trip together with along with other academics and researchers Inshallah. Along with us to finally and hopefully see Al-Quds fully liberated. Actually, all of Palestine, inshallah, fully liberated. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Omar Nashebi, political commentator and lawyer, expert in human rights, for joining us to talk about the role of the West Bank as a shield for Al-Quds and for the axis of resistance. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about the violence that erupted in Khartoum, Sudan.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Fighting in the Sudanese capital Khartoum rage for many days now after deadly battles between paramilitaries and the regular Sudanese army that left scores of people dead and hundreds wounded. Now, violence erupted after weeks of deepening tensions between military leader Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and his deputy paramilitary commander Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo over the planned integration of Dagalo's rapid support forces, the RSF, into the regular army. More details in the following report.
The battles that broke out in the Sudanese capital Khartoum and in other parts of the country last week were a direct result of a power struggle between members of the military leadership in the country. Currently, clashes are taking place in strategic locations across the capital between members of the paramilitary rapid support forces and regular Sudanese army forces. But what is exactly the background to the conflict in Sudan? Since the October 2021 coup, the Sovereignty Council has run the government in Sudan, and there are two military commanders at the heart of the conflict, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, the commander of the armed forces and the de facto president of the country on the one hand, and on the other, his deputy, the commander of the rapid support forces, Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, known as Hamiti. The two men disagreed over the direction the country was taking and the proposal to transition to civilian rule. One of the main sticking points between Hamiti and al-Burhan is the disagreement over the plan to include the 100,000-strong rapid support forces in the army and over who will lead the new force next. But why did violence erupt on Saturday, April 15? The violence comes after days of tension with the rapid support forces redeploying its members around the capital in a move the army saw as a threat. There were hopes to find a solution through dialogue, but that did not happen. It is not clear who initiated the shooting on Saturday morning, but there are fears that this could exacerbate an already unstable situation. The Hamiti-run RSF was formed in 2013 and traces its origins to the Janjaweed militia, which fiercely fought the rebels in Darfur. Since then, General Dagalo has built up powerful forces that have intervened in the Saudi-led war on Yemen and in the Libyan conflict. The RSF has been accused of committing human rights violations, including a massacre in which more than 120 protesters were killed in June 2019. The growth of this force outside the framework of the army was seen as a source of instability in the country. The current fighting comes after a series of problems that followed the overthrow of President Omar al-Bashir from power in 2019 with massive popular protests against him. The army then led a coup that ended up ousting al-Bashir. However, civilians continued to demand a role in the transition to democratic rule. A joint government of civilians and the military was formed, but it was later brought down after another military coup in October 2021. Since then, the rivalry between Burhan and Hamiti has intensified. A framework agreement on the transfer of powers to civilians was drawn up in December, but talks on implementing its details failed. Meanwhile, the Sudanese find themselves today facing another period of uncertainty.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Ali Yahya, political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Ali. Now, fighting between the Sudanese armed forces, the SAF, and the rapid support forces, the RSF, threatens the security and the safety of the Sudanese civilians and also undermines the effort to restore Sudan's democratic transition for sure. But I mean, was it really a surprise, the sight of escalated violence in the presence of one military men or only military men in power, supported each by different foreign external players? Were you surprised about that?
There is no doubt that each of the two warring parties has its internal and external extensions. But the roots of the crisis were purely internal as a result of the intertwining of interests between the two parties, which began to appear from 2021 until the dispute over the framework agreement. The main disagreement was concerning the time period required to integrate the rapid reaction forces into the Sudanese army. That is, the Sudanese army wanted, within the paper it presented, to merge the rapid reaction forces within 2 years. That is the time frame of the transitional period, and for those forces to be under the direct command of the army. This means eliminating the influence of Hemeti, head of the rapid response forces, and ending his political presence and the center of power that he built since the Darfur battle in 2003 until today. While Hemeti's demand was that the merger period last for 14 years, and during these years, many circumstances would for change. Hemeti also demanded that the command of these forces be under the leadership of the country's president, who could be Hemeti himself in the event that he decided to run for the presidential position. This was the main point of contention that began with the two sides meeting during the Darfur battles, leading to an agreement on the coup against President Omar al-Bashir, and even the stage of easing the influence of civil forces in the political track. But the current dispute is about who seizes the power, and about the sharing of the spoils and the refusal of the military from both sides to escape from the ruling scene.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's very interesting, because a framework agreement on the transfer of power to civilians was actually drawn up in December, and things were going good. But talks on implementing the details between both Hemeti and al-Burhan failed. What's the main dispute there? I mean, if they sat down and they both agreed on the transfer of power to civilians, what's the main issue that started this clash or this confrontation?
As I mentioned before, the point of contention was about the time period required to integrate the rapid response forces into the regular Sudanese army. However, there is a fundamental point that I did not refer to previously, which explains the point of contention between the two men, al-Burhan and Hemeti. It relates to a personal dispute and administrative dispute. Abd al-Fattah al-Burhan, the commander of the Sudanese army, belongs to a military institution, belongs to the deep state and to the Nile state. He belongs to the hierarchy and bureaucracy in advancing within the military institution, while Hemeti, the head of the rapid response forces, belongs to the militia mentality. He belongs to the entity parallel to the army, and he belongs to the tribal sect to which his forces belong, which are the Zuraikar tribes, that is, the Darfur tribes. This means that we are talking about two people, each with a military force and a regional, social and political backup, and two people with his own project. They met somewhere, but now a clash occurred between them, which could lead Sudan to unimaginable repercussions. Is Sudan heading to the Libyan scenario, for example? That is, will each of the two forces divide certain areas in Sudan in the event that the mediations carried out by many parties do not succeed? Or will Sudan go to a scenario in which the Sudanese army tends to settle matters entirely in its favor, especially in the capital Khartoum?
In case things go the wrong side, as you were just mentioning, or get more complicated, many observers were saying that this unrest might have a direct impact on more than one regional file, especially the Renaissance Dam crisis, claiming that political confusion will weaken any Sudanese reservations about the fourth filling that is about to happen, expected to happen this upcoming summer in Ethiopia, which also throws more burden on the Egyptian regime as well. Is this maybe the first bullet in a full-fledged staged war that might incorporate Ethiopia, Sudan, and Egypt?
There is no doubt that the Renaissance Dam file is a very important file for water security, food security, and even for the national security of Egypt and Sudan together. This is because since the 1956 agreement, the amount of water obtained by Egypt was 55 billion cubic meters, while Sudan used to get 18.5 billion cubic meters. At that time, the population of Egypt was 25 million and the population of Sudan was 11 million. Today, after the population of the two countries has quadrupled to become 104 million people in Egypt and more than 40 million people in Sudan, we see that the dire need for water has brought Egypt and Sudan to a stage in which they are heading towards a strategic defeat, unfortunately against Ethiopia. Ethiopia succeeded in crossing all the red lines set by Egypt and Sudan, so that the Egyptian demands began by trying to prevent Ethiopia from building the dam. Then the ambition decreased to trying to reduce the capacity of the dam. And when Egypt did not succeed in that either, now there are attempts to fill it gradually and over a period of 3 years. There is no doubt that the unstable security and weak political position in Sudan at the present time will certainly affect the unified Sudanese-Egyptian agreement regarding their water rights, or what remains of their water rights for the Nile River, or what remains of their water rights from the Nile River.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Mr. Ali Yahya, political commentator, for joining us to talk about the recent violence that escalated in Sudan between Al-Burhan and Hamiti. And I want to thank you for joining us, ladies and gents, to get all the new important news that come out of the region of West Asia and North Africa as well in these very hard but also somewhat hopeful times, inshallah. Wait for us after Eid, inshallah. Eid Mubarak to everyone who's observing Eid al-Fitr. And I'll see you again after Eid with a new episode of the Middle East Stream. Assalamu alaikum.
The Limelight.
International Quds Day is among the legacies of the late founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him. Shortly after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini named the last Friday of the fasting month of Ramadan as World Quds Day. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Crescent International wrote in this regard, observance of World Quds Day has become a global phenomenon. On Friday, April 14th, millions of people around the world joined rallies, big and small, held in different countries. The largest rallies by far were held in the Islamic Republic of Iran, followed by such other places as Lebanon and Sana'a in Yemen. Some European countries have surrendered to Zionist influence and have banned Quds Day rallies. Germany is one of them. It has now turned its wrath against the Palestinian people. This, however, will not deter Palestinians or their supporters worldwide from holding rallies to draw attention to Zionist crimes. In Al-Quds itself, an estimated 250,000 Palestinians converged on Masjid al-Aqsa not only to offer Jum'ah Salat on the last Friday of Ramadan, but also assert their right to Al-Quds. The Zionist occupiers have not only continued their oppression and killings of Palestinians, but have intensified their attacks. It has now become routine for the Zionists to desecrate the holy sanctuary as soon as Ramadan began. The year 2023 has witnessed even more barbarism from the illegal occupiers of Palestine. The Zionist regime is dominated by neo-Nazis, who are even more barbaric than their criminal predecessors. Pushy Zionists barge onto the Nobel Sanctuary and not only desecrate the sacred space, but also indulge in beatings of Palestinian worshippers. Palestinians have been tear-gassed and beaten up inside the Qibla Mosque, the first Qibla of Muslims. Hundreds of Palestinian youth have also been arrested and dragged, their hands bound tight with plastic bands to cause excruciating pain to prisons. The Zionists get away with such criminal conduct because they have the backing of the collective West led by the U.S. Most of the Zionist alien intruders into the Holy Land have migrated from North America and Europe, East and West. While the Palestinians continue to offer valiant resistance to Zionist barbarism, the World Quds Day rallies play an important role in highlighting the Zionist regime's crimes. Other phenomena have also emerged in recent years: the axis of resistance and implosion of the Zionist entity. The resistance front has started to inflict pain on the Zionists. That was hitherto not the case. At the same time, the internal contradictions of the Zionist entity have come to the fore, exposing deep fissures among Israelis. The level of internal discord is unprecedented, and many leading Israeli regime figures have expressed deep concern about its very survival. The sooner this racist entity is dismantled, the better for the region as well as the world at large. According to Tasnim News Agency, hundreds of people gathered in New York Times Square recently to mark International Al-Quds Day, showing solidarity.